Good morning and welcome to the February 23rd edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
So it's going to be a warm one. We still have skiers out here, but it'll be a good morning to spend some time with us. Today on Mountain Money, we're going to start by speaking with Professor Rebecca Haw Allensworth about her new book, The Licensing Racket.
And then we chat with Peter O'Doherty of Need a Big Screen, or NABS Creative. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Sarah Irvin about the upcoming KPCW Pledge Drive.
Professional licensing is a very big deal in this country. Professor Rebecca Haw Allensworth estimates that some 30 million Americans must hold a professional license to do their job, more than 10 times the number of workers subject to minimum wage. And while the idea of professional licensing for, say, doctors, accountants, or lawyers is pretty familiar, the scope of licensing is far broader. Professor Allensworth has taken a deep dive into how licensing and the boards that administrate them work and don't work in her new book, The Licensing Racket: How We Decide Who Is Allowed to Work and Why It Goes Wrong. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you for having me.
So, Professor Allensworth, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, it took me many, many years. My interest in it came from an academic interest stemming from antitrust. I'm actually an antitrust professor, and I thought maybe these boards were operating a bit like cartels, and I wrote a few articles about that in theory, but then I decided to write a book and I wanted to see it in practice. So I ended up showing up at licensing board meetings over the period of really 4 years, and then it took me another couple of years to write the book. So it's really a lot of deep research.
And as you read the book, you get this vision of you going into meeting after meeting and being perhaps the only person not directly involved in the room. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. I mean, these meetings are technically open to the public, but I would say I was the only public there. I think one time I ran into a journalist.
Okay. So let's sort of bring the audience in on what we're really talking about. What is professional licensing, and what's the basic justification for it?
So professional licensing is a government-granted right to work in a given profession. And I call it a license if you can't do it without it. And I call it a professional license if you have to invest in a lot of human capital to get it, so a lot of schooling or a test. And ostensibly, it's there to protect the public from incompetent or unethical professionals. And it's really wide-ranging these days. It started out with learned professions, quote-unquote, like law and medicine, and now it extends to things like auctioneers and alarm system installers in some states. So it's really a really large set of workers. As you said, about a fifth of the American workforce has to have a professional license.
Yeah, I know I won't get a mani-pedi, you know, unless I see that license.
So let's talk about the licensing regime. We talked about how it's a need to, you need it to work, but what kinds of rewards does the structure of licensing provide to those who are able to obtain that license?
So two things, and one, it's hard to say which one is more important than the other. The first is kind of financial, and I think going into this, being an antitrust professor and watching monopolies at work, I would have thought the financial motivation was the most important one to the professions. Licensing creates scarcity, and that means that there's going to be demand is that going to outstrip supply, and prices go up for the consumer, and wages go up for the licensee. So that's the most sort of obvious and tangible way in which people benefit from a license. But I think through my research, I learned that just as important was what it meant for prestige and the esteem of that profession and that individual in society to have that kind of state imprimatur hanging on their wall. That's a huge motivator, I think, for the licensed professions to become licensed. Because after all, even though it's supposed to be about public protection, it's usually not the public or advocates for the public that are wanting licensure. It's actually the professions themselves.
And that sort of is a good segue into one of the things you talk about where you say, there's a wonderful line in the book. You say, licensing boards combine the most dangerous features of a professional association and a government agency. Let's talk about how licensing legal regimes are created and how does a typical board function?
Yeah, so I call a licensing board an inverted agency. So normally we would think of a government agency as being somewhat bureaucratic. You know, you've got full-time employees or commissioners who are working, assistant commissioners who are working to make the actual decisions. And of course, they're lobbied by industry, and industry is going to try to get as close to them as they can. The way a licensing board works is the industry doesn't have to lobby the board because the board is the industry. These boards are set up, the final decision-making power in who enters the profession and who gets kicked out of the profession. They're actually staffed mostly by members of the profession. And I don't mean people who just have the degree. I mean people who are currently working as a licensed professional, taking a couple days out of the year or out of the month to sit on this board. And what that means is that really it's synonymous, the interests of the board are really synonymous with the interests of the profession or the professional association. And the other problem with that that I saw that was somewhat unexpected was not so much about who they are, which is to say really kind of seeing things from the professional perspective, but also who they're not, because they don't really understand regulation. They don't understand, you know, the meaning of the choices that they make. They don't even really understand their own statutes and rules.
And one of the things I thought that was really interesting was, and this goes to the point you were just making, which is that when most entities are about to be regulated, they resist, right? They're concerned. They don't want to be regulated. You sort of paint a picture that when someone wants to create a professional board, there's no pushback. The legislature's got to go, well, if you want one, you can basically have one. Is that? I'm sure that's a somewhat of an oversimplification, but it's a legitimate phenomenon, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know, part of the problem is that licensing is free to the states, or so they think. Mm-hmm. You know, the licensing board's regulation, like the salaries they have to pay their lawyers, and I guess, you know, their use of the buildings and the paper pushing, it all comes out of the licensing fees. And so when a profession comes to the legislature and says, we want to be licensed, then the fiscal report on that, as far as what's going to come out of the state coffer, is usually zero. Mm. Meanwhile, the profession's pushing hard for it. The public isn't really pushing back because their interests are sort of diffuse. And the legislature figures, hey, this is a win-win. You know, the profession wants it. Maybe we'll get some protection for consumers. But really, it actually can be very costly in the sense that it creates all this scarcity, raises prices, and then may actually have sort of a perverse effect on safety, as I learned when I watched the disciplinary actions in action.
And we certainly want to get to that. But let's go like economics nerd for just a minute. How does licensing supposedly address the issues of information asymmetries and externalities? And what are they first?
Yeah, so when we talk about public protection for licensing, we're really talking about two concepts that economists talk about. One is externalities, and that is, you know, we can't just rely on voluntary market transactions to protect people. Like, so for example, you know, when I go to a restaurant, if I don't like the food, I'm not going to go back. That would be an example of a transaction that we primarily use the market to protect ourselves. An externality happens when something goes wrong in that transaction. It's going to be worse than just between the two people within the transaction. So a classic example of this is going to be most of the healthcare professions. If we have an incompetent or an unethical healthcare provider, it's not like, you know, oh, fool me once, and you know, I'm just not going to go back to that doctor. It's like you could get really sick. You could lose your life. You could really impact the whole rest of the community. And then here, you know, I think COVID and the opioid crisis are examples where licensing kind of made for a big problem with externalities. And the other is information asymmetry. You don't really know what you're getting. This is pretty straightforward. Like, you know, part of why we want licensing is I don't know what's good medicine. I don't know whether this was a good decision for my defense attorney to make. We need to have somebody like the state standing up and saying, you know, here's a minimum competency so you know that you're getting at least something minimally competent.
And so that's the theory. You know, as we go on, as you go on through the book, you sort of portray a lot of pictures, largely often with case studies that sort of illustrate the kinds of things that go wrong from an economic and from a protection perspective. Let's start with Ms. Dioff, who I think, I don't know how you pronounce that, but who is a case study in the book that really is an interesting sort of story about what you call the ratchet effect.
Yeah, so she's a hair braider. She's an immigrant from Senegal. And when she moved here, she had no idea that the thing she's been doing for money her whole life is actually illegal in Tennessee, or was at the time, unless she had a professional license. And that was braiding hair, African-style hair braiding. There's no cutting, there's no heat, there's no chemicals. It's just braiding usually synthetic hair into a client's existing hair. And she was sort of offended by the idea that she needed to go to an American beauty school, take an American exam about how to braid hair, And so she didn't do it. And what happened was she just kept getting raided by the investigators for the Hair Board, fined tens of thousands of dollars, over $10,000. And they never shut her down. And the idea was, well, we need to protect health and safety for people who may get bad hair braiding. And yet the state didn't seem to be thinking that was really a concern. I mean, imagine not shutting down an unlicensed physician, you know, not shutting down a, you know. So it was just sort of seemed like a bit of a racket. That's the racket part. And then the ratchet part is that, you know, once you get a license, you kind of go up and up and up from there. And hair is one of the oldest licensed professions. It's, you know, almost as old as medicine. And for that reason, it has had over a century to work that ratchet of requirements up and up and up. And so the hair braiding license was a little bit different, but a cosmetology license takes you now more hours than it takes to go to law school. So that's a real, hair is a real ratchet phenomenon.
And again, what we mean by ratchet is this tendency for hours to increase. And you had a number of other sort of examples of how that happens and why that happened. Why does it happen? Who's pushing it?
Yeah, so this is sort of similar to what I was saying earlier about how I would have thought the answer here was economic. Excuse me. And part of it is, the higher your requirements, the harder it is to get into a profession, the more scarcity is produced and the more wages can increase. So that is part of the answer. But part of it also is parity. Seeing yourself as being just as difficult to enter a profession as, you know, and you pick whatever profession here, insert the profession that you're most competitive with in here. So I'll give you an example. So alcohol and drug abuse counselors in the US was meant to be a relatively easier to enter profession than, say, psychology, but also provide counseling for people who need it, and in this case for drug and alcohol abuse. It started out that you needed about 1,500 hours to become of practice, like, you know, apprenticeship type thing, as an alcohol and drug abuse counselor. Over the years, alcohol and drug abuse counselors looked around and said, we're life and death. We are saving people from overdose. We're saving people from suicide. We have a very safety sensitive, very important profession. We ought to be just as prestigious and just as difficult to get into as everyone else. So 1,500 hours became 3,000 hours, became 6,000 hours, which is, by the way, the same as a medical residency, three full years.
I'm sitting here. I want to go back for a second because I'm thinking about the story you're telling about the hair braiding and holding that up to, you know, the preferred justifications for licensing. So you sort of have to wonder, you know, you would think that the market would handle both. It certainly would handle the, if you did a bad hair braid job, people wouldn't come back. And I'm not really seeing a big safety implication when there's no cutting. So this is really an interesting story about where, I take it, you think licensing has gone a bit too far.
That's right. So we identified, you know, externalities and information asymmetry as two of the major drivers for needing licensure. And I would argue you really sort of need both. Because if you just have an information problem and you don't have an externalities problem, so in other words, the transaction is not going to be really putting ripples of harm through the community, but maybe you don't quite know what you're getting. There's other ways to solve that. I mean, maybe that's a haircut, you know? Mm. It's like, I don't know if this person's good at cutting hair, but they could get special training at a special salon. They could advertise that. And then if you don't have the information asymmetry, if you know what you're getting, then, you know, it should take care of the externalities problem too. So mm-hmm. you really need both. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the professions that we're talking about, yeah, it's really hard to tell an externality story about hair. That would, you know, it's like, I'm sure my husband's not very happy when I get a bad haircut. So I guess that's technically an externality, you know, but I'm not like really sort of harming my community by having a bad haircut. Mm. So a lot of the professions that we license now fail that test for whether or not you need regulation. And I think even more troubling, even the ones that pass it, we could regulate it with a much simpler regime. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't need you to go to school for a year and pass an exam. Maybe we need an 8-hour course on how to clean your instruments, or, you know, identifying the real risks and then having the right sized regulation for them, I think, is an important way to think about it. And often that's not going to be professional licensing.
Yes, it's continuing with Ms. Dioff. I assume someone complained, put in a complaint with her or to the board. What did you observe about the different ways boards approach complaints by consumers versus those by fellow licensees?
Well, so there was a lot of drama around that particular license, the hair braiding license, so much so that it actually went up in front of the legislature. And at that legislative hearing, there was a report that said that there had been, that they had assessed, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines from unlicensed hair braiders and received two consumer complaints. So there is so presumably, yes, somebody complained. I imagine it was another licensed hair professional who didn't like the competition. So that interested me, and I started looking systematically at a few different professions. I looked at architects and engineers, alarm system installers. I looked at the hair professions, and I found that there was this huge difference in those professions between how many complaints were acted on when it was an unlicensed claim, which is to say very high. So if you said somebody's unlicensed and that was the complaint, you were going to get discipline, versus a complaint about the quality or the safety of the practice, very, very low response rates by the board. So their whole raison d'etre, their whole point of why they're not doing it. I really felt like the asymmetry in the discipline data really showed the purpose of this regulation was not to protect the public.
Yeah, you published some really fascinating sort of numbers and examples of that really does sort of create this image of these boards acting as guilds to protect their members rather than, you know, disinterested government regulators trying to protect the public. Along those same lines, I want to talk a little bit about Dr. LaPaglia and what that tells us about regulation in the medical context.
Yeah, so this was somebody that I saw at his, I believe this would have been considered his third appearance in front of the board or maybe even more, his fourth run-in with the board, let's put it that way. He had years before been arrested in his home for having a very large quantity of marijuana, but perhaps more troublingly, a bunch of drugs he had taken home from the ER, paralytic agents, things you would use in surgery, things that are just really sort of not appropriate for a physician to have at home. When the medical board found out about that, and he was charged with a state crime. When the medical board found out about that, they put his license on probation, took his DEA number, which means he can't prescribe controlled substances. And while he was under that that probationary order, he paired up with someone who had a DEA number, and they formed this little practice that was basically selling scripts in East Tennessee that were signed by the doctor who did have a DEA number, but actually it was LaPaglia doing the work. And when those pre-signed scripts ran out, he forged his partner's signature. And these were not high-dose opioids. It was not kind of your classic pill mill scenario. This was Suboxone, which is a drug that you use to treat opioid use disorder. But it does have street value. And he was co-prescribing it with benzodiazepines, which is a big no-no. So, you know, from my perspective, this was a guy who had a second chance. And he used it to, you know, forge scripts, sell them for $300 cash. He just was not practicing medicine at that point. And so the board did not see it that way. The board saw it the way that I had come to expect, which is they saw somebody who was able to tell a story about himself and his struggles, and he lied, and they gave him what amounted to be like a third or maybe even fourth chance, a disciplinary order that was essentially the same or maybe even lighter than the probation he was on at the time.
And now what about Dr. Stevenson?
I'm sorry, what?
What about Dr. Stevenson?
Are you talking about Dr. Lloyd?
Yes.
Sorry.
Dr. Stephen Lloyd. Okay, so Dr. Stephen Lloyd, this is sort of the sad part of the story to me. Dr. Lloyd was the newest board member at the time, and he actually was a real expert in opioid use disorder and prescribing practices. And he himself had struggled with pill addiction years before. He's a recovering addict. And he was the one who decided the case. And, you know, he had very little training. He knew very little about what he was supposed to do. And that's not his fault. That was the sort of infrastructure of the board. He showed up on his first day and was put in the seat. And the first case he encountered was Dr. LaPaglia, who, you know, didn't tell him the truth, told his story framed in Dr. LaPaglia's own sort of struggles with pill addiction. And Dr. Lloyd, even though I think in a lot of ways Dr. Lloyd knows better, I think he also was inclined to see things the way a physician does, which is full of forgiveness, full of second chances. And so he really drove those deliberations that led to the inappropriate licensing decision.
One of the disturbing things, as you go into some great detail about some of these medical situations, is the tendency of what happens to doctors who have trouble to sort of go down the ladder of medical care and wind up being the people who treat the indigent.
Yeah, that's right. So often when I saw these inappropriately light decisions where somebody was going to get probation or a reprimand, you know, some ding on their license, but not a revocation, what the licensing board members often told me was, well, he'll never work again. Don't worry about it. He'll never work again. And I think they thought that was true because, of course, their experience is with the upper echelons of medicine, where you're working for private health insurance, you're working at a hospital. But the truth is that when you get a licensing decision like that, you often will lose your ability to work at a hospital. You'll lose your ability to take private insurance. In the law context, you may get fired from your law firm. Well, then what are your prospects? You know, you have a license, but you can't work in those sort of settings where you might actually have some oversight. You might actually have some accountability. Instead, you're going to hang a shingle. Maybe you're going to now be open a cash clinic, and you're going to be prescribing pain meds, or you're going to be working in a prison or the VA, or you're going to be working in indigent defense or for immigrants. You know, the client and patient population in this world is especially vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I think that by not taking these licenses, first by creating scarcity in the first place, we talked about that, and then by not taking the licenses at the other end, we're kind of sending the most problematic providers to some of the more vulnerable Americans.
Near the end of the book, you talk about the interplay between medical licensing and criminal enforcement. Why do you think that having two regulatory structures, you know, intuitively you think, oh, that's good, different people are looking at that, but you sort of argue that it actually might be worse than having one.
I think that's right. So, you know, the first problem is that the boards are already so unlikely and unwilling to go after their colleagues, essentially, that if someone else is willing to step in, or there's a perception that it's somebody else's job to step in, well, they're gonna be even more hands-off. And I saw this a lot. So when I was watching the medical board and the nursing board and the physician's assistant board, the feds indicted 30 Tennessee providers from those various professions for dealing in opioids. It was a big arrest by the Fed opioid task force. And the licensing boards did nothing for months and months. They could have suspended their licenses on an emergency basis. They could have brought cases against them. And they really didn't. And when I asked board members about this, they said, well, the criminal system is going, like, they're going to take care of it. And, you know, once they get a conviction, then maybe we can use that to take their license. But it was just sort of easier to hand it over to the criminal system. So that just, you know, once you let the criminal system in, you sort of allow the licensing boards to be even further off the hook.
Yeah.
But the criminal system is a bad way to regulate a profession. First of all, not everything that's bad, you know, about a profession, something that's unsafe about a profession, is also a crime. So, you know, it's not going to be a huge overlap necessarily between things you might want to go after. And then also it's like, those feds were loaded for bear. I mean, some of the people that they brought cases against were like huge overprescribers, millions of pills, deaths. And then some were like, you didn't keep the right paperwork for the hydrocodone that you gave to three of your patients in 2017. And that person was gonna go to jail for 20 years too. So it's just it's a very imprecise, inexpert way to regulate the professions.
So now what would you do to fix the professional licensing world, profession?
Well, okay, so it's a lot easier to diagnose the problem than just come right in and fix it all. I wish I was Elon Musk here. That would, if I could channel him, I would maybe feel like I could do some good. Okay, I'm joking, by the way. I don't know that Elon Musk is going to deliver us all from this, but at least he could give a more radio-ready answer to that question.
I'm still visualizing someone wanting to be Elon Musk, but we'll let you continue. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's something about the confidence, right?
Yes,
like,
yes.
You know. I say in the book that the thing that really drives this problem, the thing I really identified as the center of the problem, is who's doing this regulation. And I think if we had the right interests and the right people doing it, and again, only for the professions where we need it, so we could get rid of licensing for at least a third, maybe half of the professions that we have. In some cases, you'd want to pass some laws about sanitation or, you know, bonding, lesser things you can do. But okay, so let's get rid of licensing for a half to a third. And then for the ones for which we really need it, I think states have two options, and maybe they should do both in order to take more responsibility for their own regulation. First, they can make these boards advisory. They can say the final decision is going to be vested in an actual state bureaucrat. And now here's where I will differ with Elon Musk. He wants to get rid of the bureaucrats. I actually want to double down on the bureaucrats, because it was the bureaucrats, it was the lawyers who were slapping their foreheads along with me. They knew that what the board was doing was inappropriate, and they had no power. So I would like somebody who has that expertise in regulation and that perspective to have more of a say in the final decision. The other thing you can do is change the board to be not dominated by members of the profession. If you need to have two or three members of the profession to provide their perspective and their expertise, I think that makes a lot of sense. But the rest of the board should be made up of people who have a different perspective, you know, patient advocates, people who have a vested interest in the regulation, but not from the self-interest of the profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We've been speaking with Professor Rebecca Hall-Allensworth about her new book, The Licensing Racket. It's a great read, and it's been a great conversation. Thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. It's fantastic.
Most of us have been to an arena for a sport or music event and seen the Jumbotron video screen. I think we can all agree that those screens are not portable. Nowadays, you may see similar screens at a hotel ballroom, conference center, or even a remote location. There's a company right here in Park City that is part of the evolution and accessibility of portable, scalable LED screens. We were lucky to be able to catch up to them between gigs. Peter O'Doherty from NABS Creative. Good morning, Peter, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning, guys.
Tell us your background in the event industry. This is the event industry, is that correct?
Yeah, we're definitely in the event industry. I started out, very long, many years ago, when I was about 13, 14, got a job in a hotel. Worked probably 1,000 weddings, 50 concerts, conferences by the time I left school. Ducked out of it a little bit, but you always end up ducking back into it. And then throughout life, you get drawn back into it. And then one of my passions is motorsport and sports. And I got drawn back into doing more and more and more for motorsports and sports over the years. And I guess one mistake compounded by another mistake, followed by another mistake. And now I'm firmly planted in the event industry on the technology side of it and the experience side of it, as it's become known nowadays.
And where did all this start out? I'm just hearing your accent.
Ireland. I moved from Ireland over here on another two trips, trip-ups or mistakes. I was working over here. I had a client in my motorsport era, which is now the UMC. It was Larry H. Miller Speedway, racetrack at the time. And while I was over here working, my wife got offered a job to come over here for a year. That's nearly 15 years ago now, and we're still here. So that's what brought us here.
And what is your current business?
NABS Creative is the name of the company. NABS stands for Need a Big Screen. Need a Big Sound, Need a Big Show, Need a Big Stage. So we had the Need a Big Screen name, and everyone shortened it down to NABS. So we took the name that everyone was calling us and became that name rather than trying to force the issue.
And how big a geographic scope do you service?
We have 7 states left in mainland America that we haven't done an event in.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's one of my focuses this year is to knock 3 or 4 of them off the list if I can.
And what is the range of services that you provide?
It's It starts with technology, video screens and audio and the ability to go into a greenfield site and make it look good, make it sound good, bring the event closer to the crowd. We do an event in Maryland, which is a 5,000-acre international horse race, of which there's only five in the world or six in the world now. There might be another one, I think. We put audio on a nine-mile run.
You know, nine-mile run of
three
cable?
Out. It's three out, three back. You've got go around the arenas. You go around the areas. You add the whole thing up. We put 49,000 feet of fiber and audio cable on the ground, and we bring audio and video, 14 LED screens. So wow. You're making sure that people who go to the event have an experience and want to come back.
And how much of that equipment, I mean, let's just break it down a little bit. We're talking about LED screens. I take it your principal outdoor technology that you use in this area is large LED screens. How big are they?
You can make them as big as you want. I mean, we have mobile. We have so you measure a screen by the quality of the image, the size of the screen, and in mobile terms, how high they lift. And we have the two largest high lift, best quality screens in the USA at the moment. It's a competition. Mm-hmm. Next person to build them will build one a foot bigger or a millimeter better in quality. We've been the leader in that field in America.
And how big are those, the ones that you're talking about?
Those ones are 30 feet by 17 feet, and they go 21 feet in the air to the bottom of the screen. So they go over most bleacher grandstand. It's big. And then we go down smaller. We have partners and we have our own screens at 24 feet. Then we go down to 17 by 10. We try and keep the aspect ratio for most IMAG, image magnification scenarios. But when you go into a conference, their panels, their individual panels, like twice the size of a television, you can connect them together. We have over 1,000 panels, so you can build huge screens, long, different shapes.
It's like Legos.
Yeah, not as simple.
Legos.
But essentially, they're modular, and you're basically taking little pieces and putting them together. To build what you want.
And now, how do you move these pieces around?
Haulers, trucks. I mean, we do so many events. It's yesterday I was down at a high school, actually down in Heber. They're moving their graduation outdoors because of a clash that has meant they've graduated 2 weeks early. So, you know, we're an AV provider, but we're also helping them graduate when they should graduate because we're able to go into their football field and we'll arrive with a small enough trailer to fit in the gate and we'll carry the screens one at a time or cases and roll them in and build them on the football field for them. So it's a solution as well as, you know, that gives you the solutions. And the larger ones, haulers. You know, haulers and vans and trucks. There's a lot of event industry hauling and transport going on. If you look at Park City during Sundance, those people are driving the rest of the country all year.
Mm-hmm. And are there some rules of thumb that tell us how big a screen has to be and how far away the people have to be to get the kind of presentation that you're looking at?
There's a rule of thumb and a rule of wallet.
Right. Okay.
Everybody wants the bigger screen. There are other things as well. You can't have too big a screen blocking the action. Mm-hmm. So, again, racetracks being an example or horse racing. If you put a big screen in the right location, it's normally blocking some of the action because you've got a lap. So there's all kinds of, again, we did a graduation where we added television screens at the request of the organizer, and all the students were watching television and all the photographs are the top of their hat. So there's positioning and there's actually, It's experience. Gray hair goes into a lot of it as to what you can get, what you can do.
So if you have like an off-road motorcycle or truck race, how far away can someone stand and still see one of your screens clearly, see the action clearly? Like half mile?
Well over 1,000, 1,500 feet. Mm. I mean, we do the smaller screens cross rodeo arenas at 300 feet plus a grandstand and work perfectly. So nice. If you take the larger ones, they're three times as big. It's, again, you don't normally, in an event that big, you normally have spaces. and you create spaces.
Now, historically, for indoor venues, projection technologies were used. Are those fading away, for lack of a better term, in favor of using LED technologies?
Yes and no. There's lots of elements, again, price and concept. If you want to have a room that's bright enough to work in, you go LED. If you want to save a little bit of money, a lot of the time you go with the projection screens.
Because it's cheaper, I take it. Certainly in terms of setup and takedown.
Our industry has got smarter and faster. So we are, and the other thing is sometimes a lot of the hotels will have the projectors built in. So but they take up more space. You have to have somewhere for the projector. The screen is there, whereas an LED screen can go flat against the wall.
Oh, good. So now you keep mentioning LED panels. So I assume someone wants a certain size, and then you add the panels. And how do they talk to one another?
They just all connect together. They're like, think of loads of computer monitors, and you add them on, and you just tell the processor how many there are and what size you want the screen, and we can process anything from a laptop, a Zoom call, a camera. We can do full production. We have a production truck that will take 20 cameras and graphics and video and produce sports events, put them out on LED screens, stream them, put them into TV, record them as well.
So we're hearing about this. Can you give us some examples of some of the events here in the community where people might have seen your stuff and not known it was you?
Right outside this window, we did the Olympic 20-year party. We had a screen on right in front of City Hall there. We put the screen up there for the weekend. We do a lot of community events here. We do NAC, National Ability Center fundraisers. We're doing Red, White, and Snow. And we do the Barn Party. We do 6 community movies with Park City Film all over Summit County. We do the Canyons Form Fest. We've done the screens for that. We've supported Park City Performing Arts. We did some video for them this year on their new stage, which was fantastic. I hope we come back. I think the community loved that. We do Running with Ed, the greatest relay fundraiser. We do some watch parties. We've done most of the Olympic Park events. Like, we've done 2 biathlons, I don't know, 10 or 12 speed skating events. We do Summit County Rodeo and Fair. We've started building the overflow screen. We got involved with Morgan Rodeo and built it back up now to a huge rodeo when it was kind of struggling a little bit, and we might even add a day to it this year. So they're the community events we do. So we do a lot. Over the years, we've done 25 or 30 or 50 Sundance venues. If anyone remembers the pink buildings on Main Street Lift, we were the manager or the producers of those buildings as well.
Nice. So if Sundance leaves, is that going to take a little bit of business away, or will you be able to fill elsewhere in the country?
We'll fill. We'll work. Sundance is great when it happens. It's kind of a lottery. You know, you work with people, but Sundance leaving, I mean, there's 2 ways of looking at this. Sundance themselves have to understand their own DNA and how much of that is as a result of location and Park City. I always look at anchored events that move, and they don't do very well. And the people who move them normally end up moving on, other people come in, and the whole DNA changes. So, you know, same thing, different place, different thing, same place is a great industry rule. If you're going to take the same thing of Sundance to a different place, is there a different place that can actually produce the same thing? That's a big question to ask. And on our side, and Park City side, and the event industry side, we're not all going to go away and stop doing stuff. Something is going to come and fill that. There's many, many, many examples. I give the one of Toyota pulling out of Formula One. Everyone said 1,000 people leaving, $700 million out of the industry. Formula One isn't struggling. And all those people went to work, and all the other motorsports, smaller series and projects, took off, and motorsport was better for it. So whatever happens, Park City's good, Sundance will morph and survive, and we'll probably get through it.
Let's say, for example, Cincinnati gets Sundance. Will you truck your stuff out there to work with them, or is that economically not viable?
Well, Sundance bring a lot in from out of state. I mean, over the years, there's been more out of state people coming in. Part of that is Utah companies really need to step up as things move and change, you know, and it's hard. We get winter. Winter is a much slower time here than it is in California. It slows down everywhere, but it's definitely harder here for the event industry. I would travel if it made sense and we had the right partner and the right client, we would travel.
Nice. So how do you market this? How do you get the word out about what you do?
Very badly. it's a word of mouth industry. As a salesman, as an owner of the company, I make promises. I have a crew that have to keep those promises. I have to enable the crew to keep those promises, and the crew have to want to keep the promises. You don't have full-time employees, so you're always bringing in contractors and partners, and it's a constant roll around. Since before COVID, we were a completely different structure and a completely different industry. And since COVID, the industry has changed. A lot of people went freelance and saw the benefit of being freelance. It's word of mouth, you do a good job, you advertise, you invite people to an event that you're running and you grab more out of them, and obviously online and marketing. Everything that you can do for someone to give you, every phone call that comes in is a bonus to the business.
Okay, so if one of our listeners or a bunch of our listeners want to get in touch with you, need a big screen, need a big stage, need a big sound, yeah. I think I got them all. How can they find you? Do you have a website?
NABScreative.com.
Outstanding.
NeedABigScreen.com also goes to there as well.
Excellent. Well, we've just spent a few minutes with Peter O'Doherty of NABS Creative. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The KPCW's Pledge Drive is coming up next week. We want to take a few minutes and talk with our station president, Juliana Allely, and our development director, Sarah Irvin, about why it is we have to do these kinds of pledge drives and how our station finances basically work.
Great. Thanks, Kevin and Roger. Thanks so much for having us on this morning. Yes, next week you're going to hear my voice, Sarah's voice, Roger a little bit as well, all next week for 4 days, talking about the station and why your support is so important. Your funding, your donations help us provide you with the services, the news, the lost and found, the new community campfire show, all of those things we can give you guys through your support. The funding that we rely on, just the pledge drives themselves, you know, we do it twice a year. It's about 25% of our revenue, all of those call-ins and online donations that you guys make, as well as the Broadcaster Club memberships and renewals that come through during those time frames. Again, about 25%. Underwriting also makes up about 25%. We've got other not foundational grants. There's the RAP grant that we love and rely on. Those make up about 10%. And then, of course, there's the Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding that makes up about 12% of our budgeted revenue. So it's very important that we hear from all of you during Pledge Drive. And actually, we've been counting. I think we've been accepting. We're always accepting donations, but we're keeping that count date. I think we started that. When did we start that?
Earlier, Sarah. In February. So donations that have come in are counting towards our fundraising goal for this winter pledge drive. And we will continue accepting donations and counting them towards our fundraising goal through Sunday, March 9th. But really the active on-air fundraising, as Juliana mentioned, you'll hear us Monday through Thursday of next week. That's March 3rd through the 6th. And what we really enjoy about our KPCW pledge drives, and we've heard from our nonprofit partners and our sponsor partners, as well as our listeners, that they enjoy it as well, is that we really make them inclusive for the whole community. We do our very best to incorporate a lot of the different nonprofit voices that you hear throughout the year here during the local news hour, as guests on our public affairs shows, of course, for PSAs and events on our community calendar, and of course, just general news reporting. The nonprofit community here in Summit and Wasatch counties is incredibly strong, and they, you know, rely on KPCW throughout the year to help get the word out about their events and programs, and twice a year we ask them to come in and help us fundraise so that we can continue to provide that communication tool for those nonprofit voices. And one of the things that allows us to do that is that we pair each nonprofit with a sponsor for each hour of the pledge drive. Those are for-profit entities. Sometimes they are individuals who just really feel passionate about KPCW and one of those nonprofit causes. And the sponsorships are a contribution, a charitable contribution to KPCW, and they help jumpstart the hour goal, really, that we set a goal for each hour fundraising-wise. So those sponsorships help jumpstart that fundraising towards that goal and help the nonprofit in studio with them earn free underwriting credit, which is something unique that KPCW is able to offer to our nonprofit partners as a way of thanking them for fundraising for the station. We are able to offer up to 100 free spots per nonprofit that they can use following the pledge drive and save some valuable marketing money. So by sponsoring an hour of the pledge drive, businesses or, as I mentioned, individuals not only support KPCW directly, but help that nonprofit partner earn that free underwriting credit. So it's a great way to multiply the impact of a charitable gift. And we are, I'll make a pitch, we are still looking for some sponsors. We are specifically looking for sponsors to partner with Park City Soccer Club, Park City Sailing, and Lucky Ones Coffee. So if any of those are passions of yours and you are interested in serving as a sponsor, or you know a business that would be a perfect sponsor for one of those hours of the pledge drive, we would love to hear from you. You can email me directly, sarah@kpcw.org, or give us a call here at the station.
Now, Sarah, does Sarah have an H in it?
Sarah with an H at kpcw.org.
So, Julian, I want to go back to that breakdown of funding. You mentioned the Corporation for Public Broadcasting money. With all the turmoil in Washington, is the sort of public radio community concerned about potential cuts to that funding?
Yes, we're definitely concerned and aware, keeping an eye on all activity in Washington, D.C., at the executive level and the congressional level. You know, not getting into the weeds too much, but for the immediate future, we're not concerned. That funding is solid for our fiscal year 25. But again, very aware and keeping our eye on those things, because while we don't feel a significant risk, obviously things are changing quickly in Washington.
And I know you come from a background as an accountant, and I believe you've only done one side of the ledger in our discussion so far, which is, you know, where the funding comes from. Let's talk about what we spend it on.
Sure. So our biggest line item is our staff, right, our resources. And that's almost 50%. Actually, it is 50% of our budget is all the salaries, benefits, healthcare, professional development as well, to make sure that our team here that is providing these services to you, the community, are doing it well and are educated well about it, and, you know, just know what is going on in the industry, whether it's going to a professional journalism conference or going to a development conference to understand what the best practices are in the industry. You know, so it's important that we grow our team that way as well.
And we have a number of, we have a pretty fully staffed newsroom now. We have reporters that are designated to cover Park City, designated to cover Summit County, designated to cover Wasatch County. And again, maintaining that staff, and, you know, you have multiple levels of any good newsroom has reporters, it has supervisors, so there are layers that have to be done to maintain our standards of journalism. Yes, Sarah.
No, and I was going to say, Roger, to that effect, not only is it a fully staffed newsroom, but the expectation that stories are published as quickly as possible is something that, you know, we've become accustomed to in this world of social media. People want to know right away when something has happened, but our newsroom needs to vet that. They need to fact check. We're not going to publish anything that is just rumor or hearsay. So there is definitely that sense of urgency, but the newsroom does it professionally and, to the standards that we have set for this community. And so to that effect, we also have invested heavily in our digital outreach as well, and digital social media, digital online, the launch of the new and improved KPCW mobile app. All of that costs the station a lot of money, but it's something that we know is important to this community. And so when you support us during our active fundraising times of the year, like the pledge drive, you're helping us to expand those services.
So we're not just a radio station. We also have a website, social media pages, you know, of course, our website, kpcw.org. And I don't know what our social media is. You can just go to Instagram
you can
and
go to,
Facebook
it's,
and find
it's
it.
At KPCW Radio on Instagram, on Facebook, and on X.
Nice. And next week on Mountain Money, we will be going through, we are the first hour of Pledge Drive, mm-hmm. so it is the best time to call in, because the premiums, and Sarah has got us some fantastic premiums.
It's true. When you give to KPCW during our Pledge Drives, you can also get a thank you gift in return. And as you mentioned, Roger, during the 9 a.m. hour next Monday, it's Promontory Foundation who will be the guest in studio. They're a gold level sponsor of ours. We want to thank them very much for their sponsorship, as well as the other gold level sponsors, Park City Mountain Epic Promise and Deer Valley Resort.
Okay. Thank you very much for speaking with us on that. We'd like to thank our guests today, Professor Rebecca Hall Allensworth, Peter O'Doherty, Sarah Irving, and Juliana Allily.
We also have to thank our sponsors. We could not do a show like this without our fabulous sponsors. Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry Residences, San Francisco Design, and Lisa Schneider of Raymond James & Associates. As we mentioned, next week on Mountain Money, we will be doing Pledge Drive. There will be horns, there will be buzzers, and what I really hope there will be are phone calls from you. It's the best time to call in at 649-9004. Our theme music was written by Parker Swenson and is performed by Swenson, David Becker, and Tony Ellison.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.